In the war that lasted 11 days. The fighting is stopped after fierce resistance by Palestinian groups and firing thousands of rockets at the regime, forcing it to declare a unilateral ceasefire.
A year ago, Israeli regime forces bombed hundreds of buildings in the Gaza Strip during the 11-day war, also known as the Sword of Al-Quds Battle. The wanton Israeli attacks claimed the lives of over 260 Palestinians, including scores of children and women. The Gaza-based resistance groups, mainly Hamas, the Islamic Jihad, and the Popular Resistance Committees, also fired some 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war. The Sword of Al-Quds battle began when Hamas's Izzeddin al-Qassam brigades attacked the Israeli regime in retaliation to Israeli attacks on Palestinians in Al-Quds' Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Overwhelmed by the significantly developed military capabilities of Palestinian resistance factions, the Israeli regime was forced to announce a unilateral ceasefire.
During the Sword of Al-Quds battle, Palestinian resistance factions fired thousands of rockets against the Zionist regime, forcing it to desperately call for a ceasefire after 11 days. The resistance is prepared to respond to any aggression, and nowadays the military capabilities of the resistance are better than last year. The Zionist enemy must understand that attacking Al-Quds will result in a new war.
The 11-day war saw the heaviest fighting between Gaza resistance factions and Israeli regime forces since 2014. Over the past decade, Palestinian resistance factions in Gaza have been boosting their production capacity for homemade rockets and drones. During the May war, Israel's Iron Dome also proved to be a failure. The multi-million-dollar high-tech missile system was unable to protect the Israeli regime.
During the 11-day war last year, 2021, Hamas and the Palestinians scored very well against Israel in a number of things. One is the launching of rockets against Israel closed very much Israeli airports, port, and the Israeli business community. In addition to that, the Palestinians succeeded in unifying all fronts.
The Israeli regime has waged four wars on the Gaza Strip since 2007 under the watchful eye of the international community.
Experts believe in any future war, the Israeli regime will be dealt a heavy blow by Palestinian resistance groups in the Gaza Strip. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Welcome to The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and these are our guests in today's episode of The Spotlight. Attorney, activist, and political analyst Zakir Ahmed Mayat is joining us out of Johannesburg. Also with us will be journalist and activist Khaled Barakat from Vancouver.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, both gentlemen. Now, let me ask Zakir. Let's begin, Zakir, our discussion by considering the fact that this time around, unlike the previous wars where we had some mediators, this time it was Israel that asked for a ceasefire. What does this signify?
Well, definitely, I think it's a correct reflection of the facts. Israel is a very different state to what it once was. It has now become a glorified police force as opposed to one of the most powerful militaries on the face of this earth. What this signifies is a complete collapse and erosion of the very fundamentals of the state of Israel. Israel was established on the principle of terror. Deir Yassin, we are very familiar of the massacres of Deir Yassin and the terror that was caused and sown into the Palestinian population to allow for mass exodus. This policy becomes cemented, if I can use that word, 1967 when Arik Shrinum and Ariel Sharon says that the key principle is deterrence capacity, the Arabs' fear of us. And that is the fundamental that is used for many years and even tries to find its roots in 2006 under the instructions of Major General Giora Island, and closer to home, the head of Northern Command was Hadi Eisenkot. This shows us that after 2006, after the first head-on defeat of Israeli Zionist apartheid colonial settler regime at the hands of the Hezbollah, it has never been able to recover, and now it's not even able to wage an effective war against the starved and besieged population in Gaza or the subjugated occupied Palestinians. It's the end of the Israeli state, and we're seeing it before our eyes.
Mm-hmm. Now, Khaled, what do you think makes Israel regime's last year war on Gaza different? How was it different from the rest of the Israeli invasions?
It was different because the Palestinian resistance involvement in this engagement have unified all Palestinian people behind it, and also it unified not just Palestinians in Palestine from the river to the sea, but also Palestinians in the diaspora as well. And we saw that this time it was different because the Palestinians inside Israel, inside 1948 occupied territories, they were fully engaged and participant in the uprising, the uprising of unity, as some Palestinian called them. And at the same time, it was different because Palestinians have actually demonstrated a very well-organized resistance, where all forms of actions were carried on by Palestinians, whether in the West Bank or Jerusalem or in Lid, in Yaffa, and also outside in the diaspora. And I think that when Palestinians are united, not just in a sentimental way, but in reality and in the program of struggle, we began to see a division in the Zionist regime internal situation. So when Palestinians are united, also it showed that the Palestinian Authority was irrelevant to this whole scene, and that those Palestinians who have been advocating for negotiations with Israel or security cooperation with Israel were very much marginalized and put on the side. Palestinians definitely have won in this last round of confrontation.
Now, Zakir, let's now talk about the recent tension and escalation that you hear in the news almost every day in the occupied territories. What factors, in your opinion, have been responsible for the tit-for-tat operations almost on a daily basis?
I think it does find its roots in last year's Operation Sefer Quds. And this was a declaration by Israel's own internal military sources, particularly the Miramit Center for Counterterrorism and Intelligence, where they openly declare that a new equation is on the ground. The equation is, if there are any aggressions or attempts to change the status of Beit al-Maqdis, of al-Quds, there will be a response. What has changed, and we've seen it now in the last few days, is that Israel has been awoken to a new form of operation. So usually they expect a retaliation from Gaza in the form of projectiles, rockets, etc., mortar shells. However, what we are seeing is operations being conducted within the borders of Israel, and this has truly shaken the fundamentals of the Israeli state. What does that mean? The fundamentals of the Israeli state is that they want a war at a distance. They are not a population that can handle confrontation on a day-to-day basis. They are comfortable, they are soft, and they are entitled and privileged, much like the Afrikaner was here in apartheid South Africa. He was entitled, he was privileged, and the African population was fine the distance. It was when the battle is brought to the home front, that is when the situation changed here in South Africa, and I believe that the people of Palestine are in that exact position now. There's a massive change in the modus operandi, and it does put Israel at a massive disadvantage because they don't have the capacity to deal with a multi-front operational attack.
Mm-hmm. Khaled, the Tel Aviv regime has given its troops full freedom to kill Palestinians. You know, they spot the Palestinians who attack the soldiers, which is a natural response. They kill them, and then they go and attack their villages and towns and destroy their homes. What will be the result of such a practice?
Well, Israel have been doing this since its establishment, the collective punishment of the Palestinian population. And we see this over and over on a daily basis, particularly because they want to make the Palestinian resistance very costly for the Palestinian people. They know that the only way and the only reason that we have a strong Palestinian armed resistance is because it has a popular incubator and a popular support. No resistance would be able to continue its task without people's support. So Israel wants to punish our people every time, there is an action of resistance. We saw that in Jenin. Lately, we saw that also in other villages and towns in the West Bank. And they want the Palestinians to start, what they call the burning of conscience operation in Jenin in 2003. And that is to, push Palestinians into despair, starvation, making their life, daily life, difficult. But again and again, Palestinians for the past 74 years have demonstrated an iron will in terms of their ability to carry on the tasks of struggle. And that's because resistance for Palestinians is not a matter of just a decision that people make. It's a way of life. Existence is resistance, for Palestinians, whether they are in the West Bank or whether they are in Gaza or Jerusalem or in the diaspora. Mm-hmm.
Zakir, as you know, the Israeli land grab policy is being pushed further every day. Palestinians are losing more and more of their land and their homes. The settlement expansion is going on. We have 700,000 Israelis living there. So what's on the horizon for the Palestinians? Also on the excuse that they have no construction permits, they're losing their homes, they're being demolished, and no such permits are being issued for the Palestinians. So how much more of their lands will the Palestinians be losing?
I'm going to address your question in two parts. The first, I'd just like to touch on the response of the fellow guest and a colleague. I think I agree on this part, that they are trying to create the cost for the resistance operation, but they failed to do that in Lebanon through 006. They rolled out something called the Dahiya principle. For each rocket, they have to level a neighborhood in Lebanon so as to cause pressure on the Hezbollah. Today, Hezbollah is stronger than it's ever been. So this principle is doomed to failure. And similarly, I'm going to extrapolate that principle and place it to the question that you posed to me. Is that what is the future when so much of Palestinian land is being gobbled by the Israeli machinery? And Israel is painting itself into a corner. It's a very obvious position now, because Israel is facing something called a one-state reality. It is impossible to argue a two-state solution based on secured borders and other ridiculous principles that Israel pulls out of thin air. The reality is now that it is impossible to establish a Palestinian state. It has to be now a one-state solution. You have to look at a South Africa solution. And this means it's the death of the Zionist enterprise. These aren't my words, the words of Ehud Barak and so many others. Tzipi Livni said it at the IDC Hezliya conference a few years ago. And they've said it, that if we do not give equal rights to Palestinians under a one-state banner, we are going to slip into apartheid state, which it already is. And this has been recognized by groupings like Beth Salem, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the entire world. I've said this before, the entire world is on one side, and Israel is still holding on to the relic of apartheid, which has already been thrown into the rubbish bin of history. Mm-hmm.
Now, Khaled, when you take a glance at the goings-on in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, especially in the past few years, you realize that the more violence and the more crimes committed against the Palestinians, the more resilient they have become. and the more retaliatory and stronger operations they have conducted. So the question is, why shouldn't the Tel Aviv regime not change the policy? Why should it still stick to the same old, you know, heavy-handed tactics against Palestinians?
Because the nature of the Zionist regime is a colonialist settler project that is serving the interests of imperialist forces and of the United States, and particularly the Israeli regime serves also the Israeli capitalist ruling class in this regime. So this is the nature of Israel. Israel cannot exist if it's not an expansionist state, an aggressive state, a state that commit crimes against Palestinian people, and just not just Palestinian people, but also against its neighbors, against its, you know, like the Arab people in general. And we know that there is not one single Arab country that was not attacked by Israel in one form or another. And so that's the nature of a colonialist settler state. And Israel is doomed to fail as a project because the continuation of crimes and massacres and wars, it will only lead to more Palestinian resistance, but it would also would lead to more support for natural solution, and that is the liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea, and the establishment of a society that has nothing to do with Zionism and racism and Israel. It must be a secular democratic state that people live from the river to the sea under rule. Okay. Africa has a lot of similar what is being so always but that just solution in Palestine must contain the right of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes.
Now, Zakhar, what type of a strategy would you expect a Tel Aviv regime to adopt in the face of Palestinians in the future? Would you expect any change?
Unfortunately, I don't see any prospects of change. I think the system of terrorism, apartheid, genocide, colonialism, and this general occupation mentality is ingrained within Israeli society. It's hard to break free from the mold. When Israel was established on terror, continues to practice terror and will demise while practicing terror. I think the answer to the situation is to continue with the formula. The Palestinian resistance movement in the joint operations rooms have embarked on the principle of Dawla al-Wahda, the joint movement now. What we are seeing now is, and this is a very key feature of this this conflict right now, is that it's not only the Palestinians. Israel tried to undermine BDS. It's cut the feet of BDS by normalizing with certain Arab states and trying to attract the wealth from these Arab states. But what has happened in the opposite arena is that you have this massive arc of resistance that is ready to put soldiers and arms at the disposal of the Palestinians and join them in the fight, in the final fight, the destruction of the state of Israel if it does not reform, which it won't. You have Hezbollah in the north. You have Hashd al-Shaabi in Iraq. In the last war, 2021, Saif al-Quds, Hashd al-Shaabi was already dispatching troops for the possibility of a large war. You have Ansarullah in Yemen. You have the Palestinians both in the West Bank and in Gaza, and as our dear brother has said, also within Israel proper. You have a complete system that is engulfing Israel, and Israel has no option but to continue with his brutality, and that is how the apartheid regime did the same thing until they read the writing on the wall. The question is, can Israel read?
Good question. Now, Khaled, Zakhar talked about what the Israelis are going to do. What about the Palestinians, given the situation, you know, so-called normalizations and mediations that failed? And also, of course, we have social media, we have people taking to the streets, even in Western countries, in Europe, in support of Palestinians. But on the ground, they're not receiving much practical kind of support for their cause. So what are they supposed to do?
Well, one of the most important tasks today for Palestinians, and that's an internal Palestinian task, is to establish the Palestinian National Unified Front that could not just carry the tasks of the struggle and resistance in terms of confrontation with the Zionist regime, but also the political tasks. And we have seen the complete failure of the Palestinian Authority and the illusion bath of negotiations. This Palestinian sector that have led the Palestinian Liberation Organization since Oslo until today have failed, and a new leadership has to emerge from Palestinian resistance. And we see that the Palestinian resistance in Gaza, for example, despite all the harsh conditions that they are experiencing, they maintain a unified internal front. We see in Gaza, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, from nationalists to Marxists to religious groups, are united in one joint leadership. But this is not enough. It has to translate itself into a political project that it's understood and clear by Palestinians, mm-hmm. and it will be forced on the so-called international community. That is a very tough task, but it is achievable because Palestinians have done this before, you know, and at least. And so they are to do this.
Okay, on that note, we come to the end of this show. Attorney, activist, and political activist Zakir Ahmed Mayat in Johannesburg, journalist and activist Khaled Barakat in Vancouver. Thank you very much for your insight and input. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, looking after the parents. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of looking after the parents in the Islamic lifestyle. When we look at the verse 23 of chapter Isra, where we said that Allah has talked about the being good to the parents or to be good to the parents next to his worshipping, after that, in the chapter, Allah says, إِمَّا يَبْلُغَنَّ عِنْدَكَ الْكِبَرَ أَحَدُهُمَا إِمَّا and if whether يَبْلُغَنَّ they reach عِنْدَكَ with you to the old age. Now here in the verse of the Quran, Allah has used the word عِنْدَكَ, which means near you. And it means that when they become old, near you. Now this basically conveys a message that when the parents are becoming old, it is time to respect them, it is time to serve them, it is time to take care of them, it is time to look after them. And the point which Quran is making, which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has made in the Quran, is that عِنْدَكَ. Now, we can see, unfortunately, because of the, you know, the secular or Western or non-Islamic culture that is basically is have taken the whole world, and the Western culture that is against the Islamic culture, we see that as soon as parents are becoming old, their children, they leave them in the old age houses. They do not take care of their parents. They leave the responsibility of taking care of their parents on the shoulders of the staff that is working in the old age. So this is something which is not recommended in Islam, because when we look at the Islam says, يَبْلُغَنَّ عِنْدَكَ الْكِبَرِ, they have become old near you, so they are living with you. And then there are the other orders that you need to respect them. You should not say any word that will harm them, or do not say a disrespectful word to them. So we need to be very much careful, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the importance of the parents and paying attention to the parents and to taking care of the parents in the Islamic lifestyle. And what we see from the Quran is that the time when the parents are old, Islam has paid a specific attention to this point. And unfortunately, we see that people, they ignore their parents when their parents are getting old, and maybe they are leaving them to an old age house, and by making an argument that this is the best thing for you, maybe, or there are other people of the same age. Whereas Islam says that when they have become old next to you, then what you need to do is you need to take care of them. فَلَا تَقُلْ لَهُمَا أُفٍّ. Do not say to both of them even a word of disrespect. وَلَا تَنْهَرْهُمَا. And do not repel them. وَلَا تَنْهَرْهُمَا. Do not repel them. وَقُلْ لَهُمَا. And say to them a speech which is with the noble words. So use noble words with them. Now the point is, when they have become old and when they know that my kids or our kids will leave us to the old age and they will just come to visit us once in a month, for example, and we will no more see our children and we have to live with other people's, what do they feel? They obviously feel bad. When we were kids, they never left us alone. When we were kids, we needed them and they were there next to us and they were helping us, they were raising us, and they were taking care of us. Now, when they need our help, when they need our basically services, then we are leaving them on the others. Then we are basically neglecting the responsibilities that we have, and we think that everything can be solved with the money. No, the love cannot be bought with the money. The love cannot be bought with the money. Money is not the solution of everything. Therefore, Islam says that in the Islamic lifestyle, it is necessary to have your parents next to you and serve them in the best way so that you will get your Jannah from respecting your parents, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Victory Day is celebrated on May 9th in Russia as one of the most important holidays in the country, as it marks the capitulation of Nazi Germany to the Soviet Union. An estimated 27 million Soviet soldiers and civilians were killed in the Second World War, known in Russia as the Great Patriotic War, or the holiday with tears in the eyes. This year's celebrations come at a time when Russia's relations with the West are at their lowest level. NATO countries openly supply Ukraine with weapons and conduct military exercises along Russian borders. In his speech at the parade, Russian President Vladimir Putin talked about the ongoing attempts in the world to justify the crimes of the Nazis, recalled the actions of NATO in Ukraine, and explained the reasons for the military action in Donbass.
Страны НАТО не захотели нас услышать.
The NATO countries did not want to hear us, which means that in fact they had completely different plans, and we saw it. Openly, preparations were underway for another punitive operation in the Donbas, an invasion of our historical lands, including Crimea.
Putin has defended the offensive against Ukraine, describing it as a preemptive measure.
Кто разгромил нацизм?
We saw how the military infrastructure is being developed, how hundreds of foreign advisors began to work, regular deliveries of the most modern weapons from NATO countries were going on. The danger grew every day. Russia gave a preemptive rebuff to aggression. It was a forced, timely, and only correct decision, the decision of a sovereign, strong, and independent country.
And after the traditional military parade on Red Square, the president led the People's Parade. Starting 2015, the Immortal Regiment Parade is held in hundreds of Russian-inhabited localities from Kaliningrad to Vladivostok and in other countries. It became the most significant emotional event, as there is no family that has remained unaffected in Russia. All who remember and honor their own veterans of the Army and Navy, partisans, resistance fighters, home front combatants, Nazi concentration camp prisoners, come out with a picture of their beloved, those who fought or gave their lives for liberation of the USSR and Europe.
In Russia, Victory Day remains the most important public holiday of the year. It is equally revered in many of the former Soviet republics. The Great Patriotic War, which started for the Soviets in 1941, united the entire nation and still remains a centerpiece of Russia's consciousness.
Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
The Palestinian conflict is the longest-running conflict on record for the United Nations. Multiple attempts at reaching a lasting peace have been and gone. Now, conveners of the Convivencia Initiative have spent years poring over a new document that they hope will become the blueprint for a movement that will push for a just peace for Palestinians.
People forget that for almost 2,000 years, Jews, Christians, and later Muslims lived in total harmony in Palestine. The Jews in Palestine were Palestinians. There was no division, there was no racism, there was no anti-Semitism. All these are European inventions.
The vision of stepping away from violence in Palestine and the region can only work if movements for peace are supported by genuine reconciliation and justice at their heart. Now, this bold new initiative being launched in London is putting true solidarity between Muslims, Christians, and Jews at its foundation and hoping for global success.
The suspicions around interfaith dialogue have also been an obstacle.
It was perhaps the first time I've seen something with a vision for Palestine, bringing together Jews, Muslims and Christians here in the UK and abroad, working together for justice and peace in Palestine. Because too often, interfaith dialogue is what I call lowest common denominator. I've been involved in activities with Jewish groups where they say, well, we can't talk about Palestine, or we can't talk about the settlements. And therefore, it shuts down genuine conversation about the causes of of the justice in Palestine.
Obviously, without justice and equality and freedom for the Palestinians as well as the Jewish-Israeli inhabitants of that area, there can never be a proper peace. If there's not peace in the Middle East, we know that, unfortunately, there are ramifications for the rest of us in all our societies.
With a growing list of supporters, the hope is to spread the spirit of convivencia.
Even a little child understands justice. If we don't stand against injustice and support each other, what's the point of coming together? And this is really a challenge to create a better future for ourselves, for our children, not just in Palestine, but everywhere else.
For far too long, division has defined the ongoing crisis. But this new initiative is forging the path to a united and just solution for Palestine and the world. Amina Taylor, London.
Israel has sold its Pegasus software to dozens of countries around the world, which allows spies to easily hack into mobile phones and retrieve personal data. Apparently, very high-profile individuals have been targeted. Now, the PEGA committee inside the European Parliament has been set up to investigate.
We cannot overemphasize the severity of this scandal. When this kind of spyware is used against innocent citizens, whether they're journalists, activists, lawyers, businessmen or politicians, and regardless where in the European Union or even beyond.
The European Commission has been slated for refusing to take action against Tel Aviv for failing to rein in Israel's NSO company, which produces Pegasus.
This is about the accountability of the European Commission to the European citizens and to the European Parliament. You have a duty to investigate.
EU Commissioner Johannes Hahn told lawmakers it's a matter for national governments.
Mr. Commissioner, if you say it's member states in charge, would you mind telling me which member state is actually in charge of investigating in this and protecting us?
EU countries Poland and Hungary have been heavily criticised for buying the spyware from Israel. But one lawmaker says the bloc turned a blind eye when it was revealed in 2019 that Germany was spying on its allies.
Do not be a hypocrite. Do not point Poland and Hungary. Point everyone. Because who was in charge of German government? Madam Merkel. You were shaking in front of Merkel. Everyone was silent.
There was even a commissioner saying, oh, haha, I have a very boring life. There's nothing on my phone.
Experts say the it's fine, I have nothing to hide argument doesn't hold water.
At the heart of liberalism is saying exactly the contrary. You always need to hide and to have an umbrella against the eye of the state.
The European Parliament's PEGA committee is due to conclude its inquiry in 11 months from now. Already there is a great deal of scepticism that the EU will take any action against Israel regardless of the findings. After all, it has always shied away from doing so in the past. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Days after launching a massive manhunt across the occupied territories, Israeli military forces arrested the two Palestinian youths who carried out Thursday's deadly operation in the settlement of Elad that was established on the Palestinian village of Mzera, central Israel. 19-year-old Asad Arifai and 20-year-old Subhi Sbihat were arrested in a forest near Elad. Israeli military forces, Israel's intelligence agency, and Israeli police all took part in the manhunt.
The two heroes were arrested, but we affirm that they carried out a special operation, a move that has made Palestinians feel proud. The Israeli regime mobilized all human, logistical and technological capabilities to arrest the two youths. The Israeli military establishment will try to use their capture and publish the videos of their arrest to cover its security failure. But those two proved that the Israeli security is fragile.
Immediately following Thursday's operation that left three Israeli settlers dead and four others wounded, Israeli military took a number of decisions. First, family members of the two youths, who are from the village of Rumani near Jenin in northern occupied West Bank, were arrested and interrogated, in addition to many others close to them. Experts now say the second step would be demolishing their homes as part of the collective punishment Israel imposes in such incidents. Israel urges the move is a deterrence act to force Palestinians to quit resistance.
A number of Israeli legislators and experts have promoted for killing senior Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar in response to the current wave of operations, which he has encouraged. Meanwhile, the group's military wing issued a threat for an unprecedented response and a regional earthquake should Israel attempt to harm any of its top leadership, especially Yahya Sinwar. From day one, it was crystal clear for Palestinians that the two youths would be either arrested or killed by the Israeli forces. Palestinians say what the two have done was part of their legitimate resistance. They add the operation was a heroic move and in retaliation for the Israeli crimes and the settlers' incursions into the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
NATO's hopes of securing two new additions to its military alliance are close to becoming reality as the historically neutral Nordic countries, Sweden and Finland, take serious steps towards applying for membership. The Scandinavian powers' interest in joining spiked after Russia's military operation in Ukraine began. Just the idea of a NATO expansion northwards has sparked a furious Russian response.
Both the US and NATO have made abundantly clear that they are very keen to see the two new Nordic additions to the bloc. However, with Sweden and Finland's long history of neutrality seeming to serve them very well until now, is joining the military alliance truly beneficial to their national and regional security?
NATO members, including the UK, US, France and Germany, have been applying pressure to secure the two additions. Moscow has repeatedly warned of serious consequences if Finland and Sweden join NATO, saying it would strengthen its land, naval and air forces in the Baltic Sea and even raise the possibility of deploying nuclear weapons in the area.
But what NATO is doing is to pull increasing numbers of countries within its orbit, either as direct members or as associate members, and that this then ties them to a whole number of things which they may not want to do in the future. The consequences of the end of this neutrality will not be more safety for any country in Eastern Europe. It will be an increase in the arms race on both sides. It will be an increase in military presence in those countries and elsewhere. So this is a road that people should think very, very carefully before they go down.
The coming days are crucial. Finland will decide to apply for membership by May the 12th, while Sweden, the less enthusiastic of the two, is conducting a security policy review, including the pros and cons of joining the alliance. The results are due on May the 13th. If both decide yes, the process of joining will be swift, but so too could Russia's response. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
French President Emmanuel Macron was inaugurated for his second term in a bitterly divided France. With a major portion of his voters aiming to block the far-right's Marine Le Pen, again, analysts say the first president to be re-elected in 20 years still lacks a broad mandate for more far-right economic policies. The Yellow Vests marched nationwide to send the message that they will not be intimidated or stop demanding more public opinion in public policies.
No, I'm not giving up, no. I've not been doing this for 3.5 years just so I can stop tomorrow. No way, no, no. Either we win or I die and these guys will carry on. People should never stop. They should keep going, keep going, keep going. Because this is what the governments are hoping. All governments are hoping that people give up and just let them do their thing.
The French left has put aside their squabbles and joined in a united coalition for the first time since 1936. Their goal is to prevent Macron and other conservatives from allying in another absolute majority in June's parliamentary elections. The left coalition hopes to force more compromise from a president long referred to as a liberal strongman.
Macron simply must not have a legislative majority again. The last 5 years were such a catastrophe. I hope the French people join us in the streets again because the prices of products are shamefully high, even products which are totally produced in France.
Macron's speech acknowledged the nation's disunity and said his key priorities will be the environment, the unrest in Ukraine, and European stability. The pan-European project continues to be plagued by perceptions of democratic illegitimacy and constantly rising economic inequality. A belligerent policy towards Russia may turn the Eurozone's ongoing lost decade into a lost score.
Macron's second term begins with unrest abroad, and if his first term is any guide, constant social unrest at home. Pitched social battles between Macron's far-right economic plans and a French populace unconvinced by economic austerity are expected to begin no later than this autumn. Armin Mazahari, Paris.
It's a warm welcome for an end to frosty ties. It's the second time in almost 3 years that Polish Foreign Minister Zbigniew Rau has visited Iran. His two-day trip began with a meeting with his Iranian counterpart, Hossein Amir Abdollahian. The talks were held behind closed doors, while the two diplomats briefed reporters on the themes of the discussions, which ranged from economic ties to the Russo-Ukrainian war.
We talked on important issues today, on potentials for economic cooperation. We also spoke about the Russian-Ukrainian conflict. I should thank Poland for hosting Ukrainian refugees in the Russian-Ukrainian war. Iran, for its part, has since day one called for a political solution to the crisis.
The Polish diplomat's trip comes on the 80th anniversary of the entry of Polish refugees into Iran during the thick of World War II. In 1942, Iran was a major landing point for some 120,000 Polish refugees who were forced out of Poland by the Soviet Union. Touching on the issue, the top Polish diplomat said Iran's hospitality created a cordial relationship between the two nations.
We are making the 80th anniversary of the exodus of Polish refugees from their land by the USSR. I should once again thank the Iranian nation who has hosted our countrymen, providing a safe haven for them for decades.
The Polish foreign minister underlined the significance of the 2015 deal in bringing peace, calling on both Iranian and American officials to arrive at an agreement as soon as possible.
Poland and Iran are looking forward to the success of the negotiations over the 2015 deal. When that happens, we will start extensive economic cooperation with Iran without worries over the sanctions.
Poland sits on a geostrategically important part of Eastern Europe. It could act as a gateway for Iran to trade with other European states. Iran, for its part, can also act as a gateway for Polish trade with the Middle East. The two sides cited lack of knowledge as the main reason behind their low trade, hoping that this trip will set the start for broader economic ties.
After decades of uneventful relations, Tehran and Warsaw are now determined to begin a new chapter in their ties. And this last visit by the Polish foreign minister is seen as the first step towards stronger ties between the two countries, something which could redefine the course of many unresolved issues, from the fate of the 2015 deal to Iran's ties with the West. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rohingya refugees in India are in a desperate situation following renewed detention and deportation campaigns from the administration. Schools have already been detained while some deported. Intense crackdown on the community has created fear, which has led to sleepless nights amid worries of night raids and family separations. This old man, a little familiar with the local language, says, "I don't go out of the camp and prefer dying here than in a detention camp." Thousands of Rohingya refugees in India are living in an appalling situation with little or no help from anyone. Even the UN Refugee Agency is watching as a silent spectator, they said. Their men were involved in menial work for survival. However, due to detention fear, they had no choice but to abandon work and stick together in their camps.
Finding this camp wasn't easy, and upon reaching here, panic and horror was visible on every face. They got terrified upon seeing us and rushed to hidings, saying media in India is portraying their image very negatively, and this has made their survival even harder.
According to rights activists, refugee crises across the world are alarming, but this particular community continues to be an unseen victim of immeasurable extents of violence. Based on official estimates, more than 40,000 Rohingya refugees are living in parts of India after fleeing a brutal crackdown against their community in Myanmar. Many refugees say they felt safe in India since they arrived. But over the last few years, a vicious hate campaign and their expulsion is haunting the community.
We appeal to the UN. We have no support. We need your help and the help from the Indian government to stay alive. We are in acute pain and distress. We reached here just with our lives intact. Please do not detain us, deport us, or separate us from families. Rather, kill us. We have no strength to face more.
Activists say the need of the hour is to protect the rights of these refugees and secure their survival rather than deliberately targeting them and deporting them, despite the fact their lives are under threat back in Myanmar. Rights activists have urged the Indian government to formulate a uniform refugee policy since the country has no refugee law. They urge the Indian government to treat refugees equally, regardless of caste, ethnicity or faith. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
NATO's hopes of securing two new additions to its military alliance are close to becoming reality as the historically neutral Nordic countries, Sweden and Finland, take serious steps towards applying for membership. The Scandinavian powers' interest in joining spiked after Russia's military operation in Ukraine began. Just the idea of a NATO expansion northwards has sparked a furious Russian response.
Both the US and NATO have made abundantly clear that they are very keen to see the two new Nordic additions to the bloc. However, with Sweden and Finland's long history of neutrality seeming to serve them very well until now, is joining the military alliance truly beneficial to their national and regional security?
NATO members, including the UK, US, France and Germany, have been applying pressure to secure the two additions. Moscow has repeatedly warned of serious consequences if Finland and Sweden join NATO, saying it would strengthen its land, naval and air forces in the Baltic Sea and even raise the possibility of deploying nuclear weapons in the area.
But what NATO is doing is to pull increasing numbers of countries within its orbit, either as direct members or as associate members, and that this then ties them to a whole number of things which they may not want to do in the future. The consequences of the end of this neutrality will not be more safety for any country in Eastern Europe. It will be an increase in the arms race on both sides. It will be an increase in military presence in those countries and elsewhere. So this is a road that people should think very, very carefully before they go down.
The coming days are crucial. Finland will decide to apply for membership by May the 12th, while Sweden, the less enthusiastic of the two, is conducting a security policy review, including the pros and cons of joining the alliance. The results are due on May the 13th. If both decide yes, the process of joining will be swift, but so too could Russia's response. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
In the limelight. Colorado lawsuit charges group with questioning residents about voting status, while former U.S. President Donald Trump loyalists work to sustain falsehoods about his loss. We have prepared for you an article written by Peter Stone. The piece is titled, Groups Perpetuating Trump's 2020 Election Lie Face Scrutiny and Lawsuits. Conservative groups perpetuating Donald Trump's false charges that the 2020 election was rigged have sparked a lawsuit against one in Colorado and a congressional panel investigation of another in New Mexico over aggressive tactics used to seek out possible voter fraud. The scrutiny and criticism facing these conservative groups underscore how Donald Trump loyalists in several U.S. states are working to sustain falsehoods about Trump's election loss, while launching new drives that voting rights advocates say smack of voter intimidation, often targeting communities of color. A lawsuit was filed by the National Association for Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, and two other groups in March of this year, charging that Colorado-based U.S. Election Integrity Plan, which has echoed Donald Trump's baseless claims about 2020 election fraud, has gone door-to-door in some counties, aggressively questioning residents about their voting status and sometimes bearing arms. Moreover, the House Committee on Oversight and Reform has been investigating EcoMail, a firm that helped push false claims of election fraud in Arizona and has reportedly been paid $50,000 by a New Mexico county to oversee a local audit force doing intrusive door-to-door voter canvassing. Other states, including Michigan and Utah, boast conservative groups that, under the guise of protecting voting integrity by ferreting out fraud, have been criticized for the methods they employed in seeking out potential voter fraud. Danielle Lang, Senior Director of Voting Rights at the Nonpartisan Campaign Legal Center, said, "As Americans, we expect and demand an open and participatory democracy that welcomes all voters equally." She added, "Those engaging in these pressure tactics should know that voter intimidation is a crime with serious consequences." The lawsuit against U.S. Election Integrity Plan, filed by the NAACP in Colorado, the League of Women Voters in Colorado, and My Familiar Voter, charges that the U.S. Election Integrity Plan has engaged in door-to-door voter intimidation, including taking pictures of some houses in neighborhoods with a large number of minority residents. The lawsuit charges that the U.S. Election Integrity Plan, or USEIP, representatives have at times worn badges or carried firearms when visiting voters' residences, although they are not government officials. Beth Hendricks, the League of Women Voters executive director in Colorado, told The Guardian, "We're very concerned about reports that Colorado voters have received visits at their homes from people sometimes openly armed, posing as government officials who imply, without evidence, that fraudulent voting activity occurred at their address." A Colorado judge recently rejected a motion by USEIP, the U.S. Election Integrity Plan, to dismiss the lawsuit. A separate motion by the plaintiffs' two counsels, the nonprofit legal group Free Speech for People and the law firm Lathrop GPM, to obtain a preliminary injunction to halt U.S. Election Integrity Plan's efforts is pending. The lawsuit partly rests on a measure that passed after the Civil War, called the KKK Act or the Ku Klux Klan Act, aimed at stopping white terrorists from using violence to interfere with black voters. The Colorado-based U.S. Election Integrity Plan, or USEIP, which started after Joe Biden defeated Donald Trump, is run by Sean Smith, a retired Air Force colonel who also leads Cause of America, a nationwide group that boasts that its role is to enable, facilitate, and support citizen grassroots action to restore trust in local elections. Mike Lindell, the multimillionaire Trump loyalist, who is the chief executive officer of MyPillow and has been the chief financier of Cause of America, told The Guardian that the group serves as an information hub with a presence in all 50 states, and on his website, frankspeech.com. Mike Lindell estimated he has spent between $100,000 and $200,000 monthly for salaries for the group's employees, except for Smith, who is unpaid, and other expenses. Smith was reportedly tapped by Mike Lindell to run Cause of America last fall, after Smith attended a Lindell-organized cyber symposium last summer in South Dakota, which promoted conspiratorial and baseless claims of voting fraud in the 2020 presidential election. An organizing manual for the